Hey, everyone. If you're anything like me, you often find yourself looking for business insight in podcasts. And I'm sure many of you are also into meditation and reflection to help better understand yourself. Former guest of the show, Carl Bonner, decided to launch a podcast that brings these two elements together. It's a series of guided self-reflection exercises, but specifically for freelance creatives like you and me, focusing on the struggles we face as we try to grow our businesses, while also finding more happiness in the work that we do. It's called Thanks for Thinking. It's definitely an unusual format, but if you want to grow your self-awareness, find deeper career satisfaction, and make more money, then I think this podcast might be for you. Experience it for yourself and click the link in the show notes below. Hey, everyone. Welcome back to Secrets Onyx. This is episode 134 with Andy Reid. Before I talk about this episode, I just want to mention that it's just hard to talk about anything right now when there's a crazy actual invasion war happening in Ukraine right now. I have played in front of audiences in Ukraine and in Russia, and everyone I ever met there, both of those places were so warm and so awesome. I can't believe that the vast majority of people in Russia want to be invading Ukraine. It just seems crazy to me. And here's hoping to better times. I did donate to a humanitarian cause, and I probably will donate more. And I would encourage everybody listening to this episode to donate to a humanitarian cause to help the people in Ukraine. Okay, on to happier things. I did have a great chat with Andy Reid. This is an amazing episode. We chatted about so many things, including working with artists, making them feel comfortable, what it takes to make a song in a day. We talked about working from his home. We talked about networking just by being a musician. We talked about having a community of artists in his area and helping each other out. His approach to production and mixing while he goes, and being inspired by gear. And we just talked shop about microphones and things like that. A great conversation with tons of gems and takeaways. I really think this guy has a lot of things figured out really well. So tons to learn here. I think you'll love this conversation. So with all that to say, here's my conversation with Andy Reid here on Secret Sonics. You're listening to Secret Sonics, a podcast exploring the creative side of music production. Join us weekly for honest conversations with real-world music producers and audio professionals. Hello, and welcome back to Secret Sonics. I am your host, Ben Wallach. My guest today is Andy Reid. Andy is an American record maker and the owner of Reid Recording Company, based out of Bay City, Michigan. Andy and I connected on Facebook after he heard Joe Montague's episode, and I finally reached out to see if he'd be interested to join me on the podcast, which he's graciously agreed to do. So with all that to say, welcome to Secret Sonics, Andy.
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it, Ben.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we've just been riffing already for, I don't even know, 20 minutes.
Exactly.
Tell the audience a little bit about your story. How did music start for you? How did that evolve eventually, I guess, into production, recording, mixing, all that stuff you do?
Great. Yeah, it's kind of an interesting story. I mean, I know that everybody's path is a little different, and mine actually started a lot later. I did grow up taking piano lessons a little bit as a kid, but just like every other 8-year-old, I would rather go outside and ride my bike around and get into trouble. When I was in high school is when the music bug kind of hit me. You know, this is the early 90s too, so grunge was a big thing. I was super into that, but I also had this love for like the Beatles and the Beach Boys, and you know, that was kind of not cool at the time because, you know, that was like your mom and dad's music, you know? So it was still kind of early enough where it wasn't a cool thing, but there was just something about it that I loved. When I was about 18 years old, my cousin Danny played in an all original rock band. He would sneak me in the bars to quote unquote run sound for them. And I was watching these all original shows, and that made me want to get a guitar and start writing and to get into music. And as soon as I did that, I was hooked. It was like 3-4 hours a day playing, and you know, I wasn't really good enough to play other people's songs yet, so that made me write my own, and they were awful, and I'm glad that there's no documentation of those, which is fantastic. I may have them in my
probably
attic.
Be hilarious to find though. Eh?
Oh, and trust me, I listened to a couple 4-track things, and I was going to put them into Pro Tools, and I'm like, I'm just going to let the past be the past. We'll just leave that right where it was, and I have fond memories. Yeah, I have fond memories of it. You know, it's the learning process, but yeah. So I started playing in original bands, and I was big into like the power pop thing. I was a huge Weezer fan. Like I said, the Beach Boys, Beatles, that lane, I guess.
Yeah, the more melodic rock.
Right, yeah, melodic pop rock, exactly. Power pop is what a lot of people call it. I had this band called The Haskells with my brother and my friend Todd, and we got a little, crazy enough, being from Bay City, we got this little independent label that was in Bay City that signed us and gave us, you know, $5,000 to make a record. And I was a huge Brendan Benson fan because he had released a record out on Virgin in 96. And at that time, you know, he wasn't really doing much, but I had some buddies in Detroit record a song with him. And he's like, man, he's got this fantastic all analog studio. You should reach out to him because he knows his stuff. So reached out to Brendan, made a record with him, and that was it. That was like the, you know, vintage microphones, great amps, all recorded to 1-inch 8-track. It was like the process just floored me. Thinking like, wow, I can overdub this and I could overdub this and we can, you know, all sing harmonies. And that's really kind of the thing that lit the fire under me. And within the next few years, I started to collect microphones and recording equipment. Started with a 4-track, digital 16-track, and then got into Pro Tools. And I did have some tape machines early on, too, when I had Pro Tools. So I was doing a lot of hybrid stuff because the digital side hadn't caught up yet to the analog side. Plus, I liked that process, which I still try to do as much as I can. So yeah, and other than that, I've met some great people along the way. Was fortunate enough to befriend a fellow named Donnie Brown, who's a founding member of the Verpipe. And I kind of met him when they in the late 90s, and they were kind of on their peak there. And just stayed friends with him. He's a big Beatles fan, and our basis of our relationship is pretty much on that. And yeah, and as time went on, I was filling in on guitar and bass, whatever they needed, and I officially joined the band in 2010. You know, did that for a few years. Then my daughter was born, so I kind of quit the touring thing. The studio was always kind of my main thing anyway, so at that point it was like I was just doing the gigs for fun. And yeah, so I continue to write and record music. That was the reason I got into it in the first place as a solo artist. And then I do have a band, like a studio band called The Legal Matters, which is me and Keith Klingensmith and Chris Richards from the Detroit area. And the Detroit's not too far from here, too. We do everything by how long it takes to get to that place. So it's about an hour and a half away instead of miles or kilometers or whatever the heck it is. We go by time.
Great.
Yep. And yeah, so it's been, you know, it's always going to be a huge part of what I do, and probably 90%, 90 to 95% of the people I work with are people that want me to produce and engineer. You know, it's like when I was starting off, I was just engineering and trying to learn the trade and all that stuff and all the different techniques as well. But as time went on, you know, I'm definitely more involved in the music making process, which I love. And I've kind of found my lane with that, working with a lot of solo artists who kind of need the work. So they'll come in with a song, we'll work on a groove and all that stuff, and then hire the musicians as needed to fill in the gaps to make it a full band production. And that kind of brings us to today. I'm still rocking away 5-6 days a week. I'm able to be better with my hours so I can have like a normal life. I work from like 10 to 4, 10 to 5 and get to hang out with my family at night, and everybody's cool with it. So, yeah, it's been a fantastic, weird, crazy 22 years. So, but I'm nice. Super thankful, super thankful.
That's awesome. It sounds like being a musician is a big part of the way you produce and, you know, your approach to engineering, right? Because you're a guitarist, a bass player. You know, I'm assuming when singer-songwriters come in, you're playing a lot of the instruments, you know what I mean? Like, that's part of the production, you know?
Yeah, yeah, like, and it's so much fun. You know, you're a member of a different band every day kind of thing, and I love that side of it. You know, I've definitely still have, with the people that I work with, I definitely work with some people who are, this is all they do is music, but probably 75% are people that have, you know, a 9-to-5. So this is like their day off, and it's their fun, you know, kind of golf day or whatever. And so we just jam together and figure out parts together, and it's super creative. And even though I'm playing a lot of the stuff, I'm involving them in, like, what should I play? You know, what do we need to do here? And really try to go at it from a 50-50 angle instead of being the producer that says, this is the way you need to do this. I guess I just don't have that gene to kind of tell people there's one way to do things when there's obviously like a million. So, right. I love,
and it's their song, right? Like they should have an input of like what it should sound like, right?
100%. 100%. Yeah. And I want it to be them as much as possible. So, yeah, so I'll play the guitar and the bass on a lot of the stuff, and sometimes drums and keyboards if it's within my pay grade. You know, I'm not a strong swimmer on those two instruments, but if it's like a little keyboard line or something, I can kind of hack my way through it. And you learn how to edit very well in Pro Tools when you're not as good on an instrument, which helped my chops there. So yeah, it's just a lot of it, like I said, is one-on-one with the artist. And you know, we'll try to just do a song a day and come in the morning, work on the arrangement, all that good stuff. And then by the end of the day, hopefully we have close to a finished track.
Oh, wow. That's fast. That's really fast.
Yeah.
So you're just like, song a day. That's my jam.
Yeah. Yep. 100%. And then they kind of leave with something like finished. And maybe it's just that's the way I've always liked it. You know, you feel like you've got a lot done rather than doing drums on like six songs. And then doing bass on six songs, you're into the moment, you're into that one tune, and all the gears are going, you know?
How are you able to work so fast? Like, I can get, like, a very basic demo in an hour or two, maybe, but to actually flesh out a full production takes me a long, long time. And maybe I'm too meticulous, or maybe I'm too much of a perfectionist, but, like, I don't know, do you do anything to kind of work really fast? Because, like, I'd love to learn some of those hacks.
I try to have everything ready to go. Like, that's a big thing. My drum kit's here. It's mic'd up. My channels are all set. I'll just have to tweak it per the drummer, whoever comes in. And a lot of times it's the same drummer. Like, my buddy Donnie, who I mentioned earlier, lives in Saginaw, which is right next door to Bay City. He's over here a ton. And it's all tuned up, ready to go, so I can get sounds within 10, 15 minutes on drums. And yeah, a lot of it's just having everything ready to go, so the creativity's flowing, and we're just knocking stuff out. But like, I shouldn't say done. Afterward, I'll kind of clean it up a little bit. I try to just let the idea side happen, and then I'll go back, and I'll kind of clean it up, and if it needs it, and then mix it and stuff later as well.
Yeah, but you'll even get your final vocal taken that same day, you know?
Yeah, I try to. I mean, you know, sometimes it happens, sometimes it doesn't, but most of it is definitely there. I would say, you know, like I said, 95% of the time we're done with tracking.
That's awesome. Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Yeah, I think maybe it's just like having the openness to say, yeah, this is the session, this is the take, as opposed to being like, okay, cool, let's get this down and like make sure it's cool, and then when you're inspired by the track, you'll come back and, you know, like maybe more the way I've been doing it. It's cool to just kind of be like, this is the day, we're doing it, let's go.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's just like that excitement. Like, I, you know, when I was, you know, in bands and going into the studio to record with the band, like, it's like, okay, we're going to the studio, we got to get, this is it, we're going. And, you know, we practiced, and, you know, that old school mentality of like, you know, let's actually rehearse, get in ready to go.
Right.
You know?
Yeah, and I think a lot of it that helps me out, and, you know, you get to a certain point when you've been doing it for long enough that we can easily overthink things. You know, and when you are working fast and you're like, okay, I got 25 minutes to do this bass track, it's like, I'm going to go with my gut feeling, I'm going to get a cool sound, and I'm just going to play it and get through it. And as long as the artist that's behind me is happy and I'm happy and it's doing what it needs to do, you know, maybe we have to go and punch some stuff later, whatever, that's easy enough. And that's what I said, having all these channels set up so I can just plug in and go, I can easily do a punch, you know, in 5 minutes, like the next day, if I need to. So, yeah, it's like I said, I love working fast. I really, really enjoy it, but I definitely try to not let it cut corners, you know, because when you are on a time, like if it's slow morning and we're not getting things to where we need to get them to, you know, I'll say, we don't have to finish this today. Let's just do what we can do. You can come back on the next session, and we'll finish up the vocals and whatever little frosting we need on the track. So we never really say that we're going to do a song a day. We never really talk about that. It's just that's what kind of ends up happening. So I don't want to put that pressure on the artist saying, we have 6 hours, we got to do this, you know, because that's kind of unfair. And I don't want them, I don't want them to feel rushed at all.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. And it's also, I feel like having those musicians at your beck and call is a big part of getting things done quickly. I feel like as a, you know, producer that I'm working, you know, when I'm working with a singer-songwriter, you know, I'm a bass player, so obviously that's the most natural. I could play guitar pretty well and, you know, keys okay, but I'm not really a drummer, so, you know, I'm going to program that. It's not going to, you know what I mean? But if you bring in, like, actual musicians, it's like instant. Like, the way, you know, for me to do a bass part is fast, you know, because it's my jam. I know how to do that really quickly. You know, if you have a drummer who could just do a take in, like, 20 minutes and come in and just go for it, you know, you're basically... Having that musicianship adds the dynamics that, like, producers spend all this time kind of recreating inside the computer. You know what I mean? Like, having that live reaction to the music. Like, I feel like that's massive. It's like, you know, the classic, you know, the Muscle Shoals and the Motown and, like, just these people cutting tracks, you know?
Yeah, that live feel. And that's important to me, too, because I think, like I said, most of the music that I do work on has a live dynamic to it, even if it's not done all live. We got to kind of make it feel that way somehow. And I'll do the same thing. Like, if I don't have the drummer in, I'll kind of map out the drum part and just use, like, samples or whatever. But I'll program some fills and just say, okay, we need this to be doing this to get into this next section. Stuff like that. So it does, we're listening to it, and when we're adding stuff, we know what the drums might end up being like. But then the drummer comes in and adds their flavor to it and makes it even feel a little more energetic because it has that live feel to it. So, yeah. And I hate editing. Like, I absolutely hate editing. So it's like, if it's funny because, like, if I'm playing drums, I'll be like, oh, I rushed that. And I'll fix it. But if, like, a real drummer does it, I'll be like, oh, that was awesome. You really pushed into that next section, you know, when you sped up. So it's just, you know how it goes. You're definitely more accustomed to be harder on yourself than, another musician. So we're all our own worst critics.
We're in our heads about how we do our things, right? Like, we're always overthinking this is the way I play bass. I always do that, you know, stupid pattern, when someone else listening will be like, yo, that sounds really dope, you know?
Exactly. Yeah. Just, yeah.
It's all in your head.
Right. It's like, yeah, I do that walk every time going into the chorus, and they're like, well, it works. It's like, okay, well, that's cool. I'm down with it. And yeah, that stuff used to bother me a lot. And now I'm like, man, I have five riffs that I'll play. And I'm like, I'm just going to use them every time because no one said anything bad about them.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love it. I want to take it back to your story a tiny bit. Did you have any mentors, or were you, like, mostly self-taught? Like, you know, what was the approach from being like, you know, I don't know anything to I know a lot?
Well, yeah, definitely a lot of trial and error. I would say probably most of it was done just kind of the first 5-6 years working on my own songs and just trying to learn how to produce and record. And that way I'm not, like, you know, screwing up anybody else's stuff. My buddy Donnie was huge in teaching me how to produce and how to really think about song structure and arrangement on the musical side. And then, yeah, I definitely had, there's a fellow named Glenn Brown out of East Lansing who Donnie and I were working on a project with at that time too. And he was fantastic. And I learned a lot of the engineering side from him. But honestly, the thing I took the most from him was just how he treated artists and how he just made them 100% comfortable to try things. He's a great guitarist, and I would be in there hacking away at something, and he never made me feel like I was, inferior for holding the instrument. He was encouraging, and he pushed me to be better. And so I took a lot of that, and I guess I really didn't even realize that until years later when you're actually working with other people. And you know, they're going to play way better if they're comfortable, you know, 100% of the time. So it's all about creating an environment to where they feel safe, but they also feel that they can try things. And yeah, because we're literally sitting in a chair where people come in and fail in front of us. You know what I'm saying?
It's true.
So it's like yeah, that takes a lot of guts for someone to do that. Like, especially if you've been, you know, in my scenario, I've been doing it 20-25 years or whatever, and people come in and they have to sit there and play and be okay with screwing up. you know, because they're gonna, so am I. I mean, I'm gonna screw up, you know, trying things. And as soon as we get over that hump and make it okay to screw up, then I think that that's when people start to be a little more confident and they might try something that's a little more inspiring and not worry about if they do mess up or whatever. So you get a lot of cool ideas coming from that angle instead of just being like, okay, this is the guitar part I've been practicing for 2 years on this song. This is the guitar part I'm going to play. And that's fine too. But yeah, I just try to make that atmosphere as creative as possible so everybody's comfortable.
I love that.
Yeah, Glenn and Donnie were great. And the rest of it, I think, was just, like I said, trial and error. And I've also, when I was in bands and stuff early on, I would be recording at other studios and all the engineers and stuff that I'd work with. I'd always be the annoying guy asking questions. Like, how you doing that? How you doing that? What mic is that? What is this? And, you know, everybody that I've always been in the studio with has been pretty cool. So I learned a lot from a lot of different people. And then you take it home and you apply it and you see if it works for you.
I love the idea of, like, you know, let's get that first, like, mistake out of the way and now we'll get comfortable. It's like, you know, it's like when you have, like, a fancy meal and then somebody spills, like, wine or whatever on the tablecloth. And, like, after that, it's like everything is fair game and everybody's relaxed and, you know.
Right. Yeah, 100%.
It's like all chill.
Yeah. Well, and sometimes you get these people that have played these songs live before, and I'm like, look, you played this live already. It's like, if you screw up live, it's done, and it happened. Here, we get to fix it, so you get to do it over again. So this should be way easier for you, you know, once they realize that and it's kind of settle in. And I'm in my home, too. I have a very small studio. It's in the basement of my house. My dog's always running around down here, and it's just like, it's like, okay, we're just going to Andy's house to work on some music. And I think that takes a little bit of the pressure off, too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't remember if I read it on your website or somewhere, but you try to, like, build your goal was to build a world-class home studio. Can you talk to us a little bit about that? What was, like, building your studio, and how do you keep it, you know, nice and cozy but functional, you know?
Yeah, well, space is definitely limited, so, and I think that helps me from buying too much stuff, but I guess it hasn't worked out that well, but...
It's a good try, though.
Yeah. It was a good try. Yeah, I'm a total gear nerd. I really am. And I love the art of recording. I love the history of it. I love everything about it. Weird microphones that, you know, this one has a little bit more of this thing. This one has a little bit more of this thing. And I think early on, you're just trying to not make it suck. You're just trying to learn one way to make it sound good. And then when you get to a certain point, you're like, oh, well, there's like 12 ways I can make it sound good. And then that's where the artistic side of it comes in. So I love all of that. I really wanted to be just a basic engineer and just really just push buttons and be the nerdy guy behind the desk. But I ended up being a producer that engineers. So, but I'm okay with that. I'm 100% okay with it. But yeah, all the artists that come in definitely entertain me and let me try things on the engineering side so I can have a little fun with it too. And just make the sounds a little more interesting and not so cookie cutter. And really try to cater that recording to the song and to the artist specifically. Like, I don't have, like, a go-to acoustic sound. I mean, I know I have mics that are going to work well in the situation, but it's like, I'm going to listen to the song, like, oh, okay, you're a Wilco fan. Okay, you're going to want something a little deader, you know, whatever. And really try to get their recording to be something they'd want to listen to, because they like these certain artists, and then just make it a hodgepodge of all those different bands. So that's always fun, just trying to put the puzzle together there, you know?
Yeah. Do you guys, listen to references with the artists in the room, like at the beginning of a session, in advance?
Yeah, you know? Absolutely. That's a fun part. And we'll even talk about it beforehand. Like, if we're going to start a new record, we'll have a meeting or go out to dinner and have a drink or whatever and just be like, what are you looking to do here? You know, it's like, what's your plan? And sometimes I won't even listen to demos, and it all depends. And I think everybody's a little different in that regard. And I guess I didn't finish that studio question. So over the years, I've kind of just collected gear and tried to find pieces of gear that fit, you know, everybody's ears are different, just fit my taste a little bit. And, you know, I've bought and sold probably just as much stuff as I purchased that I have now. And I've finally kind of found, you know, 18 good channels of things that I really love. And that's all I've really needed, you know? And I'd love to have a bigger space and get like a real B3 because I use that a lot. But I think that, you know, digital technology has come so far and it's ridiculous. I can't tell half the time if the drums are real and or if the B3's a plug-in. It's in the context of a song, it's so tricky to tell sometimes. So I just kind of roll with whatever I have that sounds good for the situation. And if we have to replace things, I guess things like horns, I guess that's something that I have a hard time duplicating with a digital tool. Like maybe we'll write the parts together on like with a synthetic sound and then bring in real horn players, stuff like that. So, but I found that the environment is everything. Like I said, the comfort level, whether you're in a $1 million studio or you're in someone's basement, it's like if someone's worrying about time and money and worried about screwing up, it's going to be they're going to have a hard time. You know,
do you have like a separate room for, you know, the performance, like, you know, like a live room and a mixing room, where it's all one room, you know?
Yeah, it's all just one room. I mean, I'm sitting in my side and then one half of the room is like the drums are all set up and I'll put the amps. I have ways to isolate the amps. I have lines running upstairs so I can put an amp in my hallway upstairs, which is great because my wife works from home now. So I got to pick and choose when I do that. But I'll put an amp in the bathroom to kind of isolate it, and if they're trying to get a live take together. And it's funny because, you know, you think about a small room where we're all, you kind of can't escape the music part of it. Like if you're in a bigger studio, you can kind of go to the lounge or whatever and stuff. And if people need a break, they'll take off and go get coffee or something. But you know, everybody's into the song. You can't, when it's a small cramped space, it's like everybody's in on it. And it can be challenging when band members are talking behind me and stuff like that. But I just, you know, as long as they're having a good time, that's fine with me. So I've just been able to make it work. And if I get, the only time that it's ever really an issue with the small space is if I get a really hard hitting drummer. And what happens is it just gets too overbearing down here. There's no room for the energy to escape to or diffuse. And I'll be like, you know, hate to tell you to do this, but can you hit a little lighter or can you use lighter sticks or something? It's just getting a little overbearing. I rarely have to do that, though. Rarely have to do that. Most of the drummers that I work with are very controlled hitters and stuff. So, but that's really the only time I ever really have an issue. So
making it work, you know,
it's worked out. Yeah. I thought for sure that like I'd be itching to leave this setup for years and years and years. And I've actually grown to love it and I prefer it. It's just weird.
Yeah. I really like working from home also. I mean, we're in an apartment, so this is just the spare bedroom of our apartment, you know what I mean? I love that, you know, like kind of like you, I try to do the, you know, the work-life balance thing where, you know, I have the afternoon, evening with my son. But then I could come back in here at night if I didn't wrap everything because, you know, I don't really have enough time always to do all my work. And
right.
So, like, having, you know, you could kind of choose the times where you're with your family as opposed to saying, like, okay, I'm in the studio till 6 today and then I'm home and that's, you know, it's a hard cutoff. But then you're home and you didn't do everything you needed to do and now you're thinking about it. You're not actually, like, separating the work and the life even though you're physically separated. Like,
right.
It's nice to have, it's hard and you have to find the right balance that works for you. And there's definitely positives and negatives of having it inside your home. But for me right now, the positives definitely outweigh the negatives. So
yeah.
I'm with you.
Yeah.
And it's just like making it work, you know?
Yeah, you make like, it literally. Work. And that's not to say that the other way is wrong. It's just preference. And when I get asked to go record somewhere else, I'm always excited about it. You know, I love going into another studio and messing around and it's a treat at that point. You know what I mean? Like you kind of get, it gets you out of your comfort zone and I need that once in a while. And it probably happens about 3-4 times a year. And when it does happen, I'm like, okay, cool. I get to take my mobile rig or it will go to a space that doesn't even have a studio. They want to record drums at a weird church or something. I'm like, oh, this is going to be fun. You know, like I have no idea what it's going to sound like and we're going to figure it out on the fly. And it really challenges you to be on your toes and because you can get pretty comfortable.
Yeah.
So,
well, definitely a mobile gig will definitely make you uncomfortable. I actually kind of started when I was kind of getting started or trying to like up my game in audio, I kind of said my niche is going to be mobile recording. So I built this big box with my RME interface and some preamps. And I just like, okay, I would schlep it in the car and take it to random places. I made some great connections also because I did that. And it was like very specific, but it was hard. Like, getting all the gear like before the, you know, recording and then schlepping it back afterwards and the whole like, you know, wrapping all your cables. It's just, man, I don't know how live sound people do it, you know?
Yeah. I wouldn't want to do it every day, but like I said, it's a treat once in a while for sure. But definitely, you know, you're in your comfort zone if you're in your safe space, you know, and I think that's another thing why I prefer it, because I have my keyboards all wired up, ready to go, so someone can hop right on that. But if it's a band setting and they want to play and they want to record at this one cool spot, it's that can be a lot of fun too. So yeah, there's no one right or wrong way to do it, and that's what makes this art very interesting, or this whole process.
Yeah, totally. Hey everyone, you may have heard me mention before that I recently started a Discord server for the podcast. If you want to join the conversation over there, you can find a link in the show notes or on the homepage of this podcast at secretsonics.co. In the coming days, I'm going to be sharing a sample pack there with some of my own personal samples that I use all the time in my productions. This pack will only ever be shared on the Secret Sonics Discord server, so I hope to see you there soon. All right, back to the episode. I want to ask you a little bit about work. How do artists find you, or how do you find them? How does work come through your door?
Well, that's been something that I feel I haven't really had to work hard at doing, like advertising and stuff, luckily. I think being a musician and being out playing original music, you're networking and you don't even realize it. You know, you're meeting other musicians and then they're like, hey, actually, the whole way this thing began was I released a record that my brother and I made. And it was the first record that I think I'd done like in Pro Tools maybe. And I just kind of gave it, you know, sold it out. And I had like two different bands, one solo artist and one band say, hey, do you ever think about recording other people? And I'm like, I guess like for money kind of thing, you know? And they were like, yeah, I'm like, sure. So it all kind of happened as an accident just by being a musician and meeting these other people and them liking a recording. So the more I think that you do, the more recordings that you do for different artists, I mean, those are business cards for you, you know, like those are legit business cards. They're going to do better than an ad. A good record by a good artist is going to do better things for you than any advertising I think could do. So yeah, just networking, meeting different people, and them trusting you enough as a person to let you try to make this recording. And I think early on I was always just really taken back that people would trust me enough to do these things, and when I'd only done like a handful of albums, you know. But I think it's the hang is so important. The time away from the making the music part. So, you know, I pretty much try to get along with everybody, and I have an easy time just being kind of laid back, and we all have something in common, we really do. So just finding that one thing and you know, having some good laughs and pulling up goofy YouTube videos once in a while whenever the tension gets a little heated or whatever. You know, you just got to kind of know when to push those buttons. So most of it, 100%, well, actually, all of it's just been word of mouth and networking. It's all been kind of from that point. So in Michigan, it's funny.
Relationships, you know?
Relationships, yeah. And you know, Michigan's a funny state because we have a really tremendous singer-songwriter scene across the state. We've got some great, 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 great singer-songwriters. And I've been lucky enough to kind of get to work with a lot of them. And, you know, you meet one, they make a record, they give it to three other people and say, hey, working with Andy was so much fun, you know, or whatever. We were so laid back, it didn't feel like work, whatever. And that's enticing to people. And when you're working in my home, my price point's definitely lower if they go into a big room, obviously. Right. That's huge. So they can spend more time on the creative side and not worry about the overall bill being ridiculously high. So, yeah, it's been just a nice snowball effect over the years. And now I'm to the point where I'm able to just kind of produce, and people send me demos, and if I don't think it's a good fit for them or me, I won't just say no, I'll help them find, because I know so many other producers in the state that do tremendous work. It's like, you should call this guy because he's really, really, really good at what you're trying to do with this record. And I think that just not only the relationships with the artists, but also the other producers and engineers has helped me too, because then they'll send me stuff that might be in more my wheelhouse. And I never would have guessed that it would have been that way, but thankfully it has, and it's been really cool.
Yeah, that's awesome. I love that. The referral thing is such a move, because you never know. Like, I have a rapport with you know, another audio engineer in Jerusalem, John Friedlander, who's been on the show. And, like, it's just great. Like, I'm able to send him work. He's able to send me work when it's – and, like, one of his nightmare clients was a great client for me. And, you know, some of my nightmare – you know, clients are great clients for him. So it's, like – it's just great that we're, you know, we're able to kind of, you know, say like, I'm too busy now, like reach out to John, or, you know, he's got a better facility for recording drums, and, you know, whatever. There's all, but just having that kind of rapport with another person is just like so huge, and just, or people, you know,
right.
It's just great to, it always comes back to you. You know what I mean? You're, when you scratch somebody's back, it ends up, the karma goes both ways in the end, you know?
Yeah, so. And you're not creating a competitive environment. Like, I've never felt
right.
in competition with anybody, you know, and I don't, maybe I'm just naive and I didn't think about it that way, but I'm always kind of rooting for everybody, because it's like, we're all making music, even if it's a genre that I'm not into. It's like, you know, I want this person to make their record and get their, you know, emotions out in their art. So there is the right person for that artist, whether they're just a 16-year-old kid who wants to make a rap album. It's like, he's got something to say. He called me, even though I don't do hip hop. It's like, he called me because I'm a studio. So this kid wants to make this music. So I want to help him find that spot for him to do so, you know? So and I guess that's just like, people were nice enough to help me out on the way up, and it feels good to help them too. And then
that's awesome.
And then you never know, like 6 years down the road, they might have a rock and roll band and they go, man, you know, I called this guy and he really helped me out. And then they want to go make a rock record with me, you know? So you just never know.
Yeah, that's awesome. So you mentioned, obviously it's a great fit, and sometimes you want to refer them to somebody else. What exactly are you looking for in an artist, you know, to say, hey, like, yes, I definitely want to work on this music. What's your hell yes?
Well, it's definitely, you know, the music, and if it moves me to a point where it's like, I have to do this album for sure. Personality's huge, you know, like, what is this person's vibe? If they're a little too intense and a little too high strung, that might be something that I might not be the right guy for, because I like to make it a little more relaxed atmosphere, even though I do like to work fast, you know. There are a lot of just little factors. I mean, I think you kind of just know or you don't. But probably the music is the big thing, 100%. Because, like I said, luckily I've been to a situation where I'm able to pick and choose a little bit more. And if someone does come to me to make a record at this point, I probably know who they are. And I probably heard their music and I'm like, yes, I've been a fan of the last two records you made. I'm in, you know, and you know enough about them. So even if it's like, hey, my friend Amy referred me to you, it's like, okay, I know Amy would only send me someone that I would love. You know what I mean? So it's like, you build these trusts through the artists you work with, and if they make the referral, then you know the person's a keeper, kind of thing. You know what I mean? So
yeah,
so
and totally.
It's really just become this weird little family, and everybody's in on everybody else's records, singing backgrounds or whatever. It's been so much fun, and the more that we do that, the more, you know, because people are starting to work on their third or fourth records. It's like, how do we shake this up? How do we shake this up? It's like, okay, well, let's get someone else in on this. Let's get someone else in to write songs and whatever. So everybody's just trying to use the best resources that we have to make the best records possible. And that usually includes working with other artists that I work with. So that's been fun too. But yeah, I think it's just the music is it's got to be there. If I'm going to put myself like 100% into it kind of thing, it's like, I don't want to shortchange them either. It's like, man, I'm not sure if I like, you know, it's just, it's not hitting me or something like that. It's not fair to them for me to take the paycheck. You know what I mean? So I want someone that's going to be all in on their music to work on their music. So yeah, that's huge.
Awesome. Well, I wanted to ask you, I know you also do some like mixing and mastering work, not just the, you know, song creation process. Do you get like, what does that look like? How much of your work is actually like mixing and mastering, or how much of it is just like full on production?
Yeah, most of it is full on production, but I definitely have kind of encouraged a lot of people if their budget's too high to record with me or whatnot, and they really want to take their time with it. I've definitely helped them get their own home recording set up and try to encourage them to make the record that way. And then, you know, then I can mix it and master it. When the quarantine happened, it was a lifesaver, you know, because I think a lot of people ended up recording at home just because they had to. So I really kind of pushed the mixing and mastering at that time, which worked out well because I was homeschooling my daughter and I could only do mixing and stuff at night. And I wasn't doing a lot of tracking sessions at that time. So I would say probably about 10 to 15% of my business is just mixing and mastering. So the production is definitely the biggest chunk. Absolutely. Which I like. I'm very happy with that. But once in a while, I'll get a record in to mix and sometimes, you know, different things to master. And you know, I always explain to people, it's like, you know, this is just being honest here. It's like, you know, I'm mastering at this price point because this is what I feel I'm able to bring to it. You know, it's like if you spend double this, you know, you're going to get like a mastering engineer that only masters. So I'm like, I'm just explaining where things are at. And a lot of people, they just want that little bit of extra help to kind of get them over the finish line, which I'm happy to do. So, but lately, even if it's like something if I produce and I mix, I used to master all that stuff, and I've been outsourcing it to a couple other people now. It's just ended up being so much better. I get my ears away from it. You're getting more creative input from another professional, and it's been
amen.
Yeah, it's been so much nicer that way. But if it's something that I didn't record, I will gladly master it, you know, because I'm bringing in an extra set of ears to kind of get it to a certain place as well. So, I love mixing. I absolutely love mixing, and it's probably the most challenging thing for me, mixing someone else's work, because I'm just kind of you get so used to the way you do things, and so it really makes you a little uncomfortable, you know, it really does. And I'm okay with that, because you really need to, you know, this whole thing is problem solving, and we're just trying to figure out the best way to put these little puzzles together. And just that little journey and getting it to that certain place, it's like, yes, we did it, you know? So yeah, I really do enjoy mixing and mastering other people's work. I do. I wish I was able to do more than I do, but like I said, the bulk of my time is in production work, which that's where my real heart is, for sure. And when I'm tracking with somebody and we're making a record here, I definitely like mixing as I go, because I feel like if we get this sound dialed in the way we want it, that's going to influence this next bit that we're going to work on. So and then when they do their vocal, you know, they're singing the way the record's going to sound. So I try not to steer too far away from that and then have to spend, you know, 8 hours mixing from scratch. I'd rather just kind of do it as we go, kind of thing. And that's kind of how I do that. So when you get this set of files and, you know, nothing is dialed in, it's like, okay, this, how are we going to do this? You know, so it's great. I'm definitely the type of person that I know I have so much more to learn. I have so much more to learn. I listen to records by my peers, and I'm just like, oh my gosh, that just blows me away. You know, I feel like with every project like that you get that someone else recorded, you're learning something instantly, because you're like, oh, that kick drum's kind of cool. I never would have done it that way, but I love it, you know? And you're able to talk to the engineer that recorded it and share ideas and stuff. So it's great, man. I really love that side of it as well. But in the same token, it can be a little challenging, because you will get some people that will make a record and then they'll be like, hey, I want it to sound like the Foo Fighters' last album. And then you listen to the files and you're like, man, I, it, I can't make it sound like the Foo Fighters album. You know, you know how that goes. So a lot of it is just being realistic with people and say, look, I'll get it to sound as big and rocking as I can, and then we'll just go from there, you know, and just try to like find that middle ground with people too. So yeah, it has its own set of challenges, but I love it just the same. And I think with the way the world is going and with the way home recording is booming, I think I'm going to be doing a lot more mixing, and or like people will send me a song sometimes and be like, will you add production to this and then mix it? You know, like here's the bones, you know, add your production and then mix it kind of thing too. So I have done a few of those and those are fun.
That's awesome. Yeah. I feel like there's always like when someone's recording at home, they don't have the same experience as you, and there's blind spots that they have that you, just because you've done more reps, you know about. And it's like, there's always room for that, like little bit of like, hey, like the same way the mastering engineer, you know, I have a good rapport with my mastering engineer, so he gives me some like tips like that I didn't hear in the mixing stage.
Right.
So right before I set into mastering, like I've kind of adjusted those, you know, that's exactly what I need. And like, you know, that objectivity, I'm just embracing bringing more people into the creative process. Cause I feel like when that happens, it's just better when there's more people give, you know, paying attention and listening and giving that objective, you know, feedback. It's just so huge.
And a lot of time when someone's recording at home, it's always a member of the band too. So it's like they have to play as well as record. So they're not going to pay as much attention to the detail of recording because they have to perform as well. And I know what that's all about. Like that's a whole challenge in itself, like switching gears like that in your head. You know, you're going to be more focused on what you're playing because people are going to hear that. So you might not say, okay, there's way too much low end in my guitar.
Yeah, right.
To a point where even if you cut the low end out, it's like it's so woolly that now it sounds thin. You know, so there's just things like that that, and I'll even consult people as they're doing it. It's like, okay, you know, try this a little bit more, you know, move the mic maybe a little closer to here to get more snap on the snare. I don't know, you know, whatever. Just try to help out as much as possible because it's going to make my job easier if I end up mixing it. You know what I mean?
Right.
So, and you know, you're also kind of helping someone out make a better record. And that's
totally
the end result. It's like, we're just trying to make the best records we can. I don't care how we do it. Let's just make the best record we can. It's like, I don't care if I don't play a note on an album. It's like whatever's going to make it better. You know, my ego is non-existent right now. I just want to make a great record.
Give it a decade in audio and your ego disintegrates.
It disintegrated a long time ago.
Yeah, well, you sound like so easy to get along with in the studio. And I feel like you also like don't seem stressed out. I feel like that's hard for me. Like maybe I'm projecting. Like I'm easy to get along with, but internally there's a lot of stress. How do you kind of how do you alleviate that? How are you so like, I don't know, chill?
It's hard to say. I think you just kind of get more. I used to be a little more nervous in the morning, and when you don't know what's going to happen, it can be super worrisome. And that ended up turning into the part that I love the most now. It's like I've just developed so much confidence in what I can do that I know it's going to be okay. You know what I mean? Even if we waste an hour on an idea that just didn't work, it's like, it'll be okay. We'll make up that time. I'm not worried about it. I think that it's just being comfortable and having those reps, like you said, to where you know the end result's going to get to a place where we're all going to be happy. You know, there's definitely stress. I shouldn't say that. You know, I try not to definitely portray that when people are here. I'll wait till they're gone. It's like, dang it, I should have done that differently or whatnot. But you know, it those are just little mini stresses. The only time, and I don't have people like, I know that a lot of engineers that are working with a lot of like super major label artists have that deadline stress. You know, like this has to be done by this time, and thankfully I don't have any of that, and that's awesome. I think a lot of engineers and producers that have to deal with labels and managers and stuff like that, where you're getting outside input other than the artist, I think that would drive me nuts, honestly. Like, I think that would be super hard. But I've had a little bit of that, but it's always been productive in a good way. You know, it's like, if the artist is having a hard time with something and the manager chimes in and the manager says, he will listen to you, but he will not listen to me about this one thing. And I'm like, okay, well, I'll do my best. So yeah, it's the stress factor, being at home. I used to have a hard time turning off the switch at night because it was down here. And mm-hmm. when I was getting going, I just wanted to make sure everybody happy. So if someone called or texted me at 5 o'clock and wanted a mix tweak, I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go right downstairs and do it right now. And I realized that if I just say, hey man, you know, yep, I'll do it first thing in the morning, you know, before I start my session, everybody's like, oh great, that's awesome, thank you. You know, I don't have to do everything right away. That used to stress me out for sure. And yeah. it affects your home life for sure.
It sounds like you're able to kind of like trust the process of like, hey, I've been down this road. I know how this ends up. It's going to be great. You know what I mean? And like, you know, how long will the journey take? I don't necessarily know. It's like you've kind of like let go of the agenda, but you know the end result will be what it's going to be. You know what I mean?
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I'd love to ask you a little bit about your mic locker. I know that you have like quite the mic locker. Tell me a bit about how you built that up over the years and, you know, maybe what you use some of your microphones for.
Yeah, I have like, for vocals, obviously, is the one thing that everybody is always curious about. I have like 4 mics that are kind of in rotation for that. And I can usually tell like who likes what. My Warm Audio 251 has been probably 60% of everything. I put an old RCA, I found an old RCA like 12 AT7 or something and threw it in there, and it just went like, oh, that it was really a nice little thing. And I already liked the mic before that. So that one's a lot. I love that one a lot. That's super affordable. I mean, those are under 1,000. I have a Warm 67 where I did the same thing. I bought an old Telefunken tube, an EF86. Put that in that thing, and that was cool. That was a cool little tonal shift. And then I have a couple Paluso mics that I love. I have a Paluso 47, the steel tube one, and then I have a Paluso 49, and that's a tube mic as well. So all 4 of those are tube mics, and those are the ones that I'll use on the majority of the vocals, unless sometimes it's an SM7. It depends on the singer, of course, you know, 100% of the time. Sometimes I'll put a mic up and I'm like, oh, this is going to rule on this person. And then they sing through and it's like, yeah, that wasn't what I expected. So you switch it up. So it's nice to have some choices there. For my own vocals, which I sent you a couple sound clips of, mm-hmm. like the Legal Matters and stuff, I use the RCA BK5B on my voice. And that's the old ribbon mic. That's it's more, not a handheld one, but, it definitely is the one that can take a lot of the high SPLs and stuff like that. I think they use it for like recording like gunshots on sound stages. It was designed for. And I went to a wedding. This is an amazing story. I went to a wedding a mile down my house at an old Masonic temple. Okay. I walk in and I see 5 microphones hanging from the ceiling over the stage. It was like just this old Masonic temple. I look close. I'm like, holy shit, those are RCA BK5Bs. And I'm like, why would they be hanging over a stage? That's a mic that you kind of really need to get into to kind of use, you know? So I'm like sitting there thinking, I'm like, that's like $10,000 worth of microphones just hanging there and in a weird application. So I went and I called the next day. Of course, I'm watching this wedding, just staring at these 5 microphones behind, as you do, right? Yeah, exactly. And I'm like, just telling my wife, I'm like, I can't believe those are RCA BK5Bs. And anyway, so I called the next day and I'm like, do you guys use those microphones? And they're like, well, we try to have like meetings and stuff, but they don't pick up things very well. And I'm like, well, they're older ribbon mics. And they're like, well, what do you suggest? I'm like, I'll tell you what, I will replace those mics with choir mics. And really nice choir mics. And they're like, well, what's that going to cost me? I'm like, I'll tell you what, I'll buy the mics, I'll install them, and I'll just take the other 5 mics. And I got 5 of those RCAs. And they were happy. Holy they were completely happy. And it worked better. They're like, the next meeting, amazing. They're like, man, this our meeting went so well. The people in the back were able to hear so nicely. And I'm like, great, awesome. I'll just get rid of these old mics. No big deal. So...
What's he bought them like some like LD, you know, small diaphragm condensers or whatever?
Yeah, yeah. No, I just went and got some of the Shure choir mics that people would put over like the stages for plays and stuff in theaters, and it worked out great for them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and I actually bought a couple other like handheld ones for them just because, like, you know, if they wanted to pass the mic around in a meeting, you know, I'm like, this would be good, if, you know, if you're talking a lot and people are outside in the crowd, you could use the handheld. So yeah. I love the RCA BK5Bs. I use on guitar amps a ton. I love it on certain vocals. One of the ribbons in one of them is kind of shot, but it sounds amazing. It distorts in a cool way. Recently fallen in love with the old Unidyne 57s. I bought a couple of those. Great on snare, great on guitar amps. You know, for acoustics, I like the Kohl's 4038s, the ribbon mics. Use that for overhead.
Really?
Yep. Use that for overheads a lot because you can just crank the high end on those and they sound so good.
Right. That's what people say about ribbons, right? They have such a, you know, cut off top end that when you boost it, it ends up being really, really silky.
Yeah. You know? It's nice and sweet. Yeah. Never sounds gnarly at all. So I love those, especially on overheads, room mics and stuff like that. And I have your basic, like, Telefunken M82 on kick. I really like that one. Yeah, nothing too crazy. I mean, basically, it's pretty cliche over here. It's like, yeah, this 47 is going to work on a vocal that really needs to take up a lot of space. It's like the 47 is really great for that, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
So, and then, you know, just a bunch of old junk mics that if you want to run something through a pedal, it can kind of sound cool. Like mics that used to be in that come with tape recorders and stuff like that. Have a lot of those little weird things laying around that are fun to kind of plug in. I always say it's like, I always try to do this and everybody's cool with it. It's like, I'll set up the normal mics that I'll need. And I'm like, I just got to set up one weird mic, you know, one weird mic, and I can run it through a spring reverb or something. And it's like 95% of the time it's unusable, but that 5%, it's like, that's really cool. You got something cool. Even running like a mic through like a vocoder and pushing down the key of the song while the drummer's playing is kind of fun. So it creates this like, you know, but it's also in key with the song. It's
that's
like,
neat.
It's clipping and distorting and just, yeah. So everybody that I work with gives me a lot of freedom to try goofy stuff like that. So you got to have mics for that stuff too. But yeah, everything else is pretty much standard, I think. You know, I really, those two Paluso mics I've had a long time, and, you know, for the price point to get a decent 47 was something that I've always really wanted. And honestly, I think that I use that mic on probably, there are two people I can think of off the top of my head that sound unbelievable on that thing. It's like, so I can never sell it now because I know those people are going to be coming back and they sound so good on that thing. So yeah, I think it's just trying stuff out and same with preamps, you know how it goes, you know?
Yeah, totally. I've been looking at that Warm 251 and it's nice to get a solid review from somebody. I have the Slate mic and I'm just always using the 251 on it because it's just the right balance for, you know, almost all vocals. Like 80% of vocals will just get the 251 in the end. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Oh, 100%. And it's funny because like my two like really strongest singers that I kind of work with, like that just have those voices that are just, they just leap out of the speakers. That mic just, that it's just, I just set it up and set the preamp and it's done. You know, it's gorgeous.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. Someone recommended Mike Pepe, who's been on the show is working in, he's out in LA and he has, he recommended the V251 from like the guys that build mics. I don't remember the name of the company, like Gear Space, but for like mics, it has like all the information on all the mics and they build their own mics as well.
I'm blanking. Yeah. Well, I'd like to know a little bit about that.
He recommended that one's V251. I'll have to look it up after the podcast, but
yeah,
that was intriguing, and it's also like not so much more expensive than the Warm 251. So these are things I'm thinking about in the back of my head.
No, I got you. Yeah, the Bach. I went to a studio once and used like one of the Bach 251s, and it was honestly the most beautiful mic I'd ever heard. And I know that they're like $5,000-$6,000, you know. So it's like maybe someday, you know. But I'm getting by with what I have. But it's something about the top end and those things that doesn't sound artificial. That air is just pure and just open and in the nicest way without ever sounding harsh.
Yeah, that's amazing. I just saw that Universal Audio is like releasing like a Bach 251 or something. I wonder what's going to be with that. Well, yeah, I just saw it today on Instagram.
Oh, maybe they're making a model. Are they making a modeling mic too?
You know what? I'm just going to look it up.
Okay.
The air.
Yeah, I saw that they were releasing a microphone. I didn't know. I didn't look into it yet.
Here, 60 plus years of audio recording. We're proud to finally introduce our first microphone lineup to the world. Handmade UA Bach tube and FET mics to the. I don't know, man. It says a Bach 251 with a Universal Audio logo on it.
Oh, my. That's intriguing.
Interesting. Yeah, so we'll see. Yeah. I guess maybe that could be an interesting...
The technology freaks me out, man. Like, you have that...
The amount of money you're about to lose from coming on this podcast, I'm really sorry about
that. Yeah, it doesn't. And anytime I talk to a recording nerd, it's like a fellow recording nerd, I should say. We're so bad for each other because it's like when I go to my buddy's studio in Detroit, he's like, hey, I got this Silverface Princeton, and I did like 3 guitar tracks on it, and I had ordered it while the mix was printing from Sweetwater. Like, I ordered the same amp. I'm like, well, I gotta have that one, you know? So it's like, okay, now I'm making no money on this trip. That's cool. Whatever.
Sometimes you gotta do that.
You do. 100%. Yeah.
And sometimes you don't need to do that. You know, I guess discretion is advised, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and, you know, building this studio, like, is you just kind of collect things over 20 some years and, you end up loving certain pieces and those just end up sticking and staying. And then the stuff that you're like, well, this has been sitting in my rack for a year and a half and I may have used it once or twice. And it's like, okay, that's $1,000 that I can recycle into something else that I might use more frequently. So a lot of that stuff, I'm sure everybody deals with that, you know, even just guitar players with pedals and stuff like that. You know, it's like, even if it's not right for you, it's going to be right for someone else and they'll use it. So
totally. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I sold my speakers when I bought new speakers and I you know, when I hadn't used my drum set in like 2 years, I finally sold it. So, you know, you got to get rid of that stuff to help pay for other things. You know, I needed to upgrade 100%. My monitors. So things had to go, you know. The monitors were more important, you know?
Gear is inspiring, man. It's like even plugins, it's like it inspires me, you know, it really does. Like, I'll get dorky with like this Reslo mic. I bought like a Reslo mic off of eBay and off of Reverb, I'm sorry. It was really clean and it's like an early 60s ribbon mic made out of the UK. And I found a really clean one on Reverb and then I'm looking at the message and it said Mark Lynette Studio. Well, Mark Lynette like works with Brian Wilson and the Beach Boys. And I'm like, dude, this is like, I'm like, is this like the Mark Lynette, you know, kind of thing? And messaging him. And I'm like, now it's like, okay, now I have one of Mark Lynette's microphones that he used on a Brian Wilson session. You know, it's like in my mic locker. So of course, whenever I pull that out, I'm going to tell the Brian Wilson story. And everybody's going to be like, oh, that's so cool. You know, it's just stuff like that. It can really help a session too, you know?
I love that. Yeah, it's so cool. Yeah, good for you, man. That's awesome. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about mixing because you kind of touched on it before. Tell me a little about, I know you're mixing as you go, which is something that I struggle with. I try to I spend the extra 8 hours mixing because I kind of like want that objectivity and kind of like want to build it up again. But I guess walk me through your approach to mixing in the box, hybrid, whatever it is that, you know, you're thinking about, stereo bus processing.
Yeah, I'm definitely mostly in the box now. Sometimes if it's the right project, I have an Otari 2-track tape machine and I'll print it to like quarter inch and back in. But I'm running everything out through Burl converters, which is awesome. Once I got those, I was really comfortable mixing in the box. I got the Bomber digital to analog and the analog to digital. So I have 2 channels of in and out. So I'm just kind of clocking to the Burl and just going, staying in the box. So yeah, essentially, I'll start with drums or the vocal, usually the vocal and the drums, getting the groove down. The hardest thing that early on that I struggled with, and thankfully digital has caught up to that, was like room modeling. And like I said, I'm kind of in a shoebox here. So all my drums were like, okay, the only thing I can really do here is like the super 70s dry drum sound. It's like, this is all I can really do here. So I'm just going to stick with that for a while. Now I'm able to add space to it with like the UAD Ocean Way plugin, and T-Rex has those room like the Fame Studios and Sunset Sound, and there's all these different room modelings now that are really, really nice sounding. So I'll start with getting the drums in a space that feels good for the track. Just kind of working my way up from there. Usually it's dialing things in as we make the record and then tweaking it at the end, you know, as well. How much distortion do we want to use on these things? All that. But realistically, I know that as much time as I want to spend on drums, the vocal is going to be the most important thing.
Right. You even say it on your website, right? Vocals are always going to be front and center.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's always MO.
Yeah. Well, I kind of realized that early on. And especially working with a lot of singer-songwriters, it's like, because the lyrics are so important, you know, it's really about just getting that vocal to be sitting perfectly right in the middle of that whole deal. Then moving guitars around that or keyboards or whatever is going to be there. But I'm also, you know, I think being a rhythm section guy, you know, I'll try to treat the groove just as important as the vocal and really getting that underlying rhythm section track to feel like something, you know, so it complements the vocal in a nice way. So I'll spend a lot of time on drums and bass and whatever the rhythm guitar is or rhythm instrument is. Percussion, stuff like that, and really try to get the track moving around the vocal in a nice way. That's super important to me because I think it's just something that I always have to feel that has to be there, you know? Obviously, if it's just an acoustic song with a vocal, there's not none of that comes into play, but most of the stuff I work on is like full band production, so I'll spend a lot of time on drums and bass and get the rhythm guitar. And then once I get that little bed made with the vocal, then I'll just kind of start filling everything in around it. So and I try to think of like, I'm always kind of thinking of mixing because even when I'm producing, you know, if a guitar player is like playing a part and I know that that's going to compete with the part he already played or he or she already played, I'll be like, put a capo on and play it up a little bit so it's just out of the way of that thing you already played. So it's like, I'm thinking of the mix while I'm producing because I know that if he plays higher up on the neck, it's going to mix itself in there better than if he's kind of staying in the same register as he's already performed. So even while I'm producing, I'm thinking about that mix, you know, and how everything's going to sit in there and be relative to each other, you know?
Yeah, I mean, that's good arrangement, right? That's like...
Right, I think so. Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. And same comes into like when, if someone plays an organ part and I know that that's going to... I'm like, oh, well, you said you were planning on doing like a big ooze thing in the chorus with the background vocals. It's like, let's do the ooze first if that's more important. And then we'll figure out the B3 part after that. So we know that the ooze are going to be, you know, stuff like that. So the mix kind of comes together a lot easier if everything's kind of out of the way of each other. Usually, you know, I say usually because sometimes it doesn't matter, but yeah, most of the time it helps.
And you're not running into like CPU issues when you're like mixing while you're tracking and stuff. Like, how do you deal with that?
No, not at all. I have a Universal Audio Apollo and I have a lot of outboard gear. So I really try to get everything through that printed like Pro Tools is a tape machine. That's kind of what I go for. So, you know, but you can still edit and stuff like that. So I'm definitely trying to get everything as close as possible on the way in so I'm not using a ton of plugins when I mix.
Yeah, amazing. So it's like the commitment, the old school approach, you know, of like just the Beatles, you know, just getting
That helps. And I think that helps with the speed thing too. It's like we've made that decision, let's move on, you know. And I think that making those commitments early really helps. It'll help determine where the track's going to end up going. You know, that's a lot more fun that way than thinking, well, you know, this could end up being like a Zeppelin sounding song, or it can end up sounding like a ABBA song. You know, I want to know which way we're going with this. You know, so those are two just complete opposites that I try to think of. But you know what I mean. It's like I'd rather know that
roomy or tight. You know, like
I want to go Zeppelin with this. It's like, let's go Zeppelin. If we're gonna go there, let's just go there. You know, so that helps a ton, and I think that fulfills that old analog mentality that I kind of started out with, it helps feed that part of my soul that I need to maintain in the digital world. You know, I probably don't need all this stuff, you know, but it helps me get to the space quicker. And
yeah,
it helps
no,
me
that
get,
makes
it
a
helps
lot of
me,
sense.
It helps me get sounds quicker and
right. You can get everything in your computer, but if you get it real and tactile, you're it's just so much faster to kind of get those sounds and just bake them in and just be like, yep, that's it, done, you know? I totally get it.
Yeah, it's like when you talk to these guys that still mix on consoles, it's like they don't say it's because it sounds better, they say it's because they're faster on it. You know what I mean? Like, they're like, well, this is how I know how to do it. I'm faster here. And it's like, that's why I do it. And it's like, I get it, you know?
It's hard to change gears when you've been at it also for so long. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Like, I know, you know, modern music is being made on Ableton and, you know, but it's hard for me to kind of wrap my head around that because I've been, you know, doing it my way for so long, you know? Just
right.
That's a hard switch, you know.
It is a hard switch, and I'm definitely open minded to trying whatever anytime. I love it. Like, I even tried to learn Studio One just because it was cheaper than Pro Tools, and I was sat on there for 5 minutes. It's like, oh my gosh, I don't even know how to make a track. I'm out of here. You know,
it's I had the exact same reaction to Studio One. By the way, it's like, why where are the tracks? How do I do this?
Like, I'm just sticking to Pro Tools. That's all I know. But yeah, I love. A lot of modern pop music. Like, I listen to like Billie Eilish and her brother Phineas and what they're doing, and I think it's so cool. And I would love to learn how to do more of that stuff. I really think it's awesome. So I'm trying to, you know, stick to what I know, but not be super closed off enough to where I'm not learning from the new thing, you know? So, because there's a lot of great new music being made, and it's really nice to listen to and dissect how they made it, you know, and learn something.
Yeah, absolutely. If we could go back into mixing a tiny bit, I'm curious if you're big on stereo bus processing, or if you're kind of like, yeah, let's leave it for the mastering engineer.
No, I do a little bit for sure. I try to, you know, keep it as limited as I can, but I'll definitely try to do like the stereo width thing, put like just a kind of a bland, transparent, like Fab Filter EQ to cut stuff. If things are getting a little too muddy or whatever, my kind of glue plugin is the Black Box Plugin Alliance tube loading thing. Love that thing.
What's it? The HG2 or something?
Right. Yeah. That's on everything.
So good. Me too.
Yeah. Yep. And it's like you can push it hard and get that. It'll add distortion in such a beautiful way. And then it's got the blend knob in there. You can just do that. And then, so I don't really use a lot of compression. I'll put like an L2 limiter, like the Fab Filter, just to make the mixes hotter. And for as far as like, I used to use like a lot of tape machine plugins, but ever since I kind of went with that Black Box tube loading thing, it's like, that's all the vibe I've needed. That's a good one. And I might use an SSL compressor just to kind of keep things in check a little bit. But I try to do that on the individual tracks if I can. You know what I mean? So if something's poking out, I'll try to go towards the source of what's poking and then take care of it there.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like, yeah, you could really chase your tail when you're kind of doing like the top-down mixing when you're starting from the stereo bus and going backwards, because then often you'll boost something and then it's affecting the stereo bus compressor and you go back. And hopefully I'm going to have Craig Bauer on the show, and I know he uses like VCAs to kind of get around some of that stuff. So hopefully I'll get to chat with him and learn about that.
That'll be interesting. No, that's super cool. Yeah, I love automation. I mean, honestly, like automation is the thing. But you know, it's also it's also so dependent on the style of music you're working on. So if I'm recording a lot of this acoustic-y singer-songwriter stuff, I really got to be careful because that stuff needs to breathe, you know. And you can really just close all that stuff right up and overcook it if you're too heavy-handed on the mix bus. You know what I mean? So that I really try to be careful with that stuff. And then let the mastering engineer kind of take it to the finish line.
Yeah, totally. With that, I mean, with the HG too, I feel like sometimes it's just about the blend. You know what I mean? Like I'll go 80 or I'll go like 30, depending on like, you know, how much you want it to crunch. You know what I mean? It just depends.
Yeah. Oh, it's gorgeous. It really is. And it works on everything. I think it does. It's worked on everything that I've used it for. So I'm all in on that thing, man.
I have it loaded from the get go on a mix. So at this point, it's just like, it's just a matter of how much. you know?
I bought the new one too, the one with the mid-side features, and I just haven't got into it enough. I've still been using the old one. I got to spend some time with the mid-side one, but I'm kind of nervous to try it because I'm so just like set it and forget it. On the other one, it's like, do I want to like get in there and do more surgical stuff, or do I just like let it go and not use it? So I have it and I will learn it someday, but I'm definitely using the older, the first version still on everything.
Yeah. Do you have like a template or several templates to kind of get started when you're doing the actual, like the production becomes the mix, right? It's all one session. You know, what do you see when you start, or is it just like a blank canvas?
Yeah, I try templates. I always try templates. And I think my problem with templates is that I'm always want to kind of know what my options are. So when you have your template up and you have like these two delays up, it's like, okay, I'm just going to reach for one of those two delays, which is fine. Saves time. If you know you love those things, awesome. I just kind of like to look through my reverb plugins and see like, oh, this one might be more interesting on this. And I know that I could have them up all on the same channel and all that stuff. But I just, at this point, I'm just so used to doing it that way. And it's probably from having limited CPU from back in the day. It's like, I can't put all these plugins up because I'm going to just kill my computer. So,
right.
So when I start, I always pull up the same reverb, which is just the Altiverb cello room is like kind of my favorite, or cello plate or chamber. Sorry. Ah. That's kind of like my starting reverb, and I love the Valhalla. I love the UAD. The Capital one's gorgeous. Man, there's so many good plugins, and I think that I can never really decide. Like every week, I prefer something different, and I just kind of recycle through these plugins, and mm-hmm. and so a template just kind of would, I think, ruin that for me. So. It's honestly, I have a mix bus preset that I'll just throw on, and with that tube loading thing and the fab filter, that's about it. That's where I start.
I admire your courage and exploratory nature.
Don't confuse my courage for ignorance, please. No, I think it's just the less I see, the better too. Maybe that's just that helps me out a lot. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
There's no reason for me to have a stereo chorus bus made if I'm not going to use it on anything. You know, if I need that, I'll think of it and then add it in, kind of thing.
I totally get it. Yeah. In terms of like monitoring, I know you're like in a smallish room. What is like, you know, are you, you're, I'm assuming you're working on speakers. How have you been able to make it work?
Well, for a long time, I had those JBL LSRs, which had that room correction mode in, and those were great. They were a little scooped, mid scooped. So I have a pair of Auratone, just those little guys, the little cubes. Those helped a lot. And then just this last year, I bought some Dyne Audio LYD-48s, the three ways. And I kind of went with those because they have some options on the back to like boost the low end, whether your speakers are against the wall or out into the room. And then it's got a plus or minus on the top end. Of course, I haven't touched those things. They just sounded fine out of the get-go. But being that I am in a smaller space, I don't mix very loud, which is nice. I try not to. And I think just like with anybody, I think my biggest issues are just like lows and low mids. I mean, I think whenever I mix in a big room too, it's like it's the same areas. It's like, I don't know. I think you just kind of, you're used to hearing what you hear. And I'll switch to headphones like the Sennheiser 650s. I'll kind of jump to those a little bit here and there. But yeah, mostly I really like the Dyne Audios, and it's really helped me in the last 2 years. The mids are a lot more detailed, so I'm able to kind of get the tonality of the mixes into a better spot. No sub. I don't need a sub. It's the room is, and I got treatments all over the place. You know, it's basically just a big vocal booth at this point. You know what I mean? Because you could clap your hands anywhere and it's just dead. So I have to add all the ambience in when I mix with reverbs and stuff like that, which is fun. So I love that stuff. So, but yeah, just keeping things, once I start cranking my monitors, I really start to hear those extended frequencies that my room is, because my room is imperfect, you know? So I definitely got to keep them back. And that helps me mix at a volume that's not going to you know, destroy my hearing in 5 years.
Yeah, that's great. The low volume thing. And like, you know, the headphones for, you know, the quality assurance is always a handy move. Yeah, I actually got Sennheiser HD600s at my mastering engineer's recommendation. Just because, you know, sometimes I need to work at night and I got speakers. I'm not going to blast them when I have, you know, my son sleeping. So,
100%.
You know, home studio logistics, you know, and it's important.
Right, yeah, yeah. Well, and also, like, I like the headphones, too, for clicks and pops if I miss them, for fades and making sure, because you just hear that stuff so much better on headphones. So when I get kind of close to the end of my mix, I'll throw those on, just make sure I'm not missing any weird notes. I don't know, you can just hear that stuff when it's just jammed right in your ears a little bit better. But for the overall feel, I'm probably 85% on the monitors and 15% on headphones for sure.
Yeah, and you don't, no car test at this point. It's just wrap it in the studio.
I had a Saturn for 12 years that had the worst stereo in it. And it's like, I got a new car last year. It's like, so that part, it's gone. It's like, I know if the low end's like, because the speakers were probably blown. So if I had like too much low end, it just like would rattle in the worst way. So that helped me out a lot. But yeah, I feel pretty confident with the DynaAudios. It's funny because, you know, even those first 2 months were scary as hell with new monitors. It was nuts. I was afraid to print anything because you just had to relearn it, you know? And but luckily, they've worked. I knew they were listenable and I could work on them for long periods of time. And that was the big thing for me. I didn't want anything too aggressive that was going to give me too much fatigue, you know, like NS10s and stuff like that, which I know people love and they're great. But I can't work on those for a long period of time.
Yeah, totally. I ditched the Yamaha HS80s for some Focals and they're so much less high mid. And the mid is so much better. It's just, it's a game changer. It's so much less fatiguing.
Focals are, I haven't heard a bad Focal monitor yet, honestly.
I'm not even on such expensive ones. I'm on the Shape Twins. So
yeah, but still, like, my buddy has a pair of the more inexpensive ones, and I love them. They sound gorgeous. Yeah, and you learn whatever you have in front of you. I think if you spend enough time on them, you're going to be able to mix on them. You know, it's just a matter of getting used to that, getting used to your room, all those things. Because I'm never going to, I don't even know if I've ever attempted to mix in a perfect room before. I probably wouldn't even know what to do. You know what I mean?
Right. I think there's some there's like some psychoacoustic things going on that you could kind of hear through the room almost. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
The room is lying to you, but there are some things that your ear is able to kind of do right anyways. I think. That's my hunch.
Yeah, and working with, like you said before, that relationship with the mastering engineer, it's like I work with a couple of really, really great mastering engineers, and they've really, really helped me get into some of my problem areas in my mixes and educate me on how to make them better. And then, you know, I send them another project, and they're like, dude, low end is perfect. Didn't have to touch it. That kind of stuff. It's like, well, that's because you helped me out. You know what I mean? So that's super useful.
It's also back to the relationship thing of just like having more relationships in this business makes it better. I don't know. I've gone on this tangent a bunch of times on the podcast, but just like the man cave, woman cave thing is just such, it's so unhealthy and we're so used to it because, you know, the great thing is that the technology is in all of our hands, but the bad thing is that we've lost a lot of the community and you have to seek it out. And, you know, maybe it's through the mastering engineer or a mixing engineer you're working with, or, you know, someone that you're sending things out to. It's just like, get other people on the line and just chat, you know?
Yeah. Well, and after, you know, making, I don't know how many solo records and all that stuff, it's like, I can honestly say that making music with other people is way more fun.
Yeah.
Way more fun than when you're by yourself. At least for me. That's how I see it. So if someone wants to come in and sit behind me and while I'm mixing and they have a great idea, it's like, yeah, I'm listening. Let's do it. You know, just, I love that. There's no idea is worth ignoring, I guess. You know, it's everybody, it comes from somewhere. So take a second to explore that. Unless it's a drummer, you know, saying the idea, and then you just go, it's the drummer. I'm just kidding.
They'll just spontaneously explode on stage anyways after your amp turns to 211, you know.
I'm just surprised they speak English.
Yeah.
That's a joke. Sorry. I have way too many drummer friends that I have to rip on constantly, but you don't have to. Yeah.
Drummers are so musical. Love me my drummers.
Me too.
Absolutely. Well, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you know, just creative energies. You know, we got kind of, we all have days where we're psyched to get into the studio, and then there's days where we're not as psyched. Do you, like, you know, have any maybe routines, habits, anything you do that kind of helps you feel energized and creatively, you know, motivated to do the work you do every day?
Oh, man, that's a great question. I mean, obviously, caffeine is a huge component on getting into the right headspace. My morning's a little different now, obviously. Like, I get up, I take my daughter to school. I usually have about a half an hour to kind of chill out. I like to kind of get ready for the session, and that's kind of therapeutic for me. So it's like, if it's like a drum session, I'll kind of make some decisions and plug some microphones in and kind of get closer to the finish line of what I need to do. And I'll just throw on like a record. You know, I have a turntable down here, and I'll throw on a record and keep it just really quiet in the background. And just that kind of gets me going. You know, that's about it. It's not really anything too in particular. If I know what we're going to be doing, as far as like whoever's coming in, that definitely having a little bit of a game plan helps us get right to the creative part instantly. So yeah, nothing too crazy. Just kind of like coffee and a little bit of music and session prep. You know, I really love like plugging cables in when no one's here and just making microphone choices when no one's here. And I don't know, I find that's a lot of fun for me. It's super geeky, but it's fun.
Yeah, I love it, man. I also enjoy just setting up the mic, getting ready for a session. There's something very, like you said, therapeutic. It's just like, okay, going through the motions, you're getting ready, but the client's not there yet, so you're not stressed out.
That's right.
It's nice. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Awesome. So obviously, I'm not going to let you go until we do the sauce segment. So you sent me a track called The World Is Mine by The Legal Matters. So let's have a listen to that for about 90 seconds, and we'll talk about what went into it. Sound cool?
Sounds great.
Awesome.
The world is mine. Go stand in line while your bleeding heart is beating like a drum. Don't forget to run.
Yeah, Andy, I love this track. It's super cool. What is that keyboard sound? Ba ba da ba ba. What is that? What's going on over there?
Okay, so this is actually a song that I wrote and sang for The Legal Matters.
Oh, you're the lead vocalist as well.
I'm the lead vocalist as well. Yep. So I did a lot of the parts on this one. So the piano sound is actually the Mrs. Mills piano, which is like a Beatle piano plug-in, like the super tacky one, through a Leslie simulator. So it's just a total Beatle ripoff, Elliott Smith ripoff, whatever you want to call it, all the way around. So it's just, yeah, it's just like a Leslie piano.
Sounds awesome.
Thanks, man. Yeah. So the riff is through that, and then like I said, I'm not a strong swimmer, and the regular like da da doom bum boom bum ba doom. I had to play that with like two different tracks because I'm just not a good piano player. So like I did the bass piano on one track and then the other one on the other track. So there's honestly like three pianos on that, but it's just because I can't play that well. And one had the Leslie on it. So So that track was a super fun one. It's kind of a song that kind of came together pretty quick for me. It's essentially just like four verses, you know, and I just had this idea of just making it more intense and more jarring as the track went, because it's kind of about this intense and jarring type of person. And oddly enough, the lead vocal was my scratch vocal, because I was just like kind of, I tried re-singing it and it just didn't have the energy that, or anger that that one had. And that's just through a BK5B, that ribbon mic. And I distorted the preamp on the way in. So that's all just like normal distortion.
Nice.
Because I didn't care. I was like, I didn't care. I'm just like, well, this is just for the demo. I want a little bit of distortion, and I'll just crank the preamp up. And so it's just kind of a happy accident, and I actually sang it all right. And I just That's could great. Never recreate it. I couldn't get the energy. And then my buddy Donnie came in and played drums on it. He plays on all the Legal Matters stuff, and he really brought some energy to it. I kind of had an idea I wanted for groove, and then I'm just like, at the end, I just want you to play out, just overplay, because he's a singer songwriter's drummer, so he doesn't like to, you know, like he just wants to keep things very simple and groove based. And I'm just like, it needs to be chaotic, you need to play out, you need to overplay. So he kind of did that. And with the Legal Matters, background vocals are kind of our thing. So, you know, I think I opened up the session today because I knew we were going to talk about it. I just wanted to look at it and refresh myself. And, you know, there's probably 20 background vocal tracks there, just doing different things. Chris had this goofy Tom Waits voice that he does, and we bled that in there just for like shits and giggles. And that's kind of what the band is. It's just fun. And so, yeah, the track just kind of starts from this one place and kind of grows into something. And it's hopefully it fit the lyric. And you know, as far as studio trickery, I think since the room is the Sunset Sound Studio 3 plugin, the third room, which is a little smaller, but it seemed to work really well for this track. It's two guitar parts. The main really gnarly, ugly guitar is through like a Spaghetti Western, which is like a Maestro fuzz box. And yeah, I mean, it's honestly just it's three chords and four verses. There's not a lot going on in that regard, but we tried to definitely make it more about an intensity as it grew kind of thing, you know? And that was honestly, like, I never really like, when we do these Legal Matter records, I'm usually the writer on half the songs and Chris is usually the writer on the other half. And I usually always just love all of Chris's songs and just like mine are like, whatever. And I actually like this one. So I'm glad I sent it to you. Like, this is like one that I got done with. I'm like, yeah, that was kind of fun. Cause it's definitely not a traditional verse, chorus, bridge, chorus kind of song.
Yeah.
It's kind of linear in that regard. So it tends to be a fun listen, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I listened to all the tracks you sent me, and I debated which one to do, but this one just had something very cool about like the effects, the vocal, the drums, all of it sounded really, and that like that really dope piano part.
Thanks, so just, man.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And in terms of like bass, what did you do there? Like, I know that bass is a big part of your music.
Yeah, the bass is probably my P bass. You know, that's kind of what I used on most of the record. Flat wounds. Typical, yeah. Just, I
my,
think I
my
have,
guy.
Yep, and I think I have, like, I have, the pickup that's in it is it's the one they put in the 52, like, the USA one. I mean, it's just a Squire P-Bass. Mine's just a Squire P-Bass, but I kind of gutted it, and I put that 52 precision bass pickup in it, and flat wounds, and usually I use a DI, and then just through like a 1073-esque pre. And then I have an Ampeg SB12 flip top tube amp.
Shit.
And I'll blend those two. Yeah. And nice. That's a cool little amp. It's a cool little amp. So that gets me the mid-range, you know, kind of gnarliness. And then the DI gives me the low stuff.
I was talking about, I was talking with an engineer in Canada named Josh Bowman. And he was telling me that the Sound Radix plugin, the auto line, works really well for like when you have a bass DI and amp. I don't know if that's something that you've thought about or experiment with. I'm like a pure DI bass, you know, recording. I'm very simple, but.
Well, yeah, and I am most of the time too. I just, you know, and honestly, sometimes I'll just reamp it. I'll take my DI and I'll just reamp it out into my bass rig if I need something else. I'll just use the Avid time delay thing. It just goes in samples, and usually it's within, you know, a little bit. There's also a UA plugin that's it's a Little Labs. I think it's called IBP, and it's got some time things that you can mess with it and different phase things that you can mess with too, that sometimes are just, you know, I have no idea how they work. I just push buttons and then just move knobs, and it's like, oh, that, yep, yeah, that sounds the best. Cool. All right, leave it there. So,
yeah, I'm literally a nudger these days. So,
yeah, however you got to, however you got to do it. Yeah, no, 100%. Yeah, it's however you got to do it. And that, and honestly, like, that's the only time I'll ever really mess with a lot of time stuff is when I'm just blending a DI with an amp. For drum stuff, it's like I try to just leave the room mics alone, just because it's like that is creating a delayed-esque feel anyway. So let's just, just kind of leave it that way and try to get the definition from the closed mics if I can, and get the phase in check that way.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I usually do the same. Awesome, Andy. Well, the track sounds awesome and your music sounds awesome. And yeah, also, like, I feel like we barely even said, like, that you're, like, an artist in your own right, you know, in addition to being a producer, engineer, mixer. So, like, it seems like that's also a big part of who you are. And so it's great to hear a song that you also worked on that is your own.
No, I appreciate that. And I feel like it's just kind of all intertwined at this point. I used to try to separate the things, but now it's, like, it's all just the same thing. You know, it's all related. It goes into the studio, it goes into my songs, whatever, you know?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like people try to separate or don't try to separate. You know, it's so hard for me to kind of let go of the musician thing, even though obviously I'm focused on the studio and this is where I want to be. You know, someone calls me to play bass on a gig I want to do, it's like, I really want to play a gig. You know what I mean? So, like,
yeah,
it's hard to divorce those things. You know what I mean? Like, it's all part, like, I'm in the studio because I want to play music, you know, because I wanted to play music. And, like, it's all, like, I totally relate to that. And I'm figuring that out for myself as well. So, yeah, thanks for sharing that. Yeah.
Oh, man, my pleasure. And thanks for having me, dude. It was a blast. I feel like you and I could probably talk for another 10 hours.
Yeah, maybe we will another time, you know, at a NAMM one day or something. But
that would be great.
Or just a casual catch up. But before I let you go, and another before I let you go, so I've given you two of those. You know, I ask this question on every episode, and so you probably know that it's coming. But you know, looking back on your journey, was there maybe something that you did or didn't do that you'd want to impart on your earlier self and be like, "Yo, Andy, keep at that. It's going to get you where you want to go." Or maybe it's Andy, stop doing that. It's holding you back. What would be that one piece of advice you'd give your earlier self?
Yeah, no, I knew this was coming, and I thought about it, and you know, I always feel like just every part of it is a lesson, whether it's a fail or an achievement, you know, and it all just kind of means something. But I guess if I just had, like, kind of one regret, I would have started sooner, you know what I mean? Like I said, I started at 18, but then again, you know, I had this, like, super high school, like, rough time in high school, and I turned to music and became a music lover first. So that was important, I think, for it to happen. So, but yeah, I don't know, man. I would probably just say I wish I would have started sooner, and I wish I would have, like, dabbled into maybe even, I kind of missed that window of being, like, a runner in a big studio kind of job, internship. I would have loved to have done that. That would have been fun. You know, meeting, working in like a big, ridiculous studio with like four rooms and just bounce around. And I think that would have been something that would have been very useful for me that I didn't get a chance to do.
I totally relate to that. I just mentioned Josh Bowman, and in his podcast episode, he talked about, you know, working at the Warehouse in Vancouver, which is like one of the biggest studios out there. You know, I think it gave him a really well-rounded education, you know, kind of gave him like, And even though it was maybe not so easy, but when you're in your 20s, like, that's the time to do that stuff, you know what I mean? And I got started just a bit, also, like, a bit too late for that. And, you know, by the time I wanted to do production, there was, like, no studio wanted me. Everyone's like, yeah, it's just me. Get out of here. Like, it's like, I guess I got to open a business then.
Yeah, I'll start my own. I'll get you. Yeah.
Yeah, literally, that was the only option I could see. And it is what it is. You know, we just got to keep going onward and do the best we can with what we're given. And anyways, Andy, it's been super, super awesome. Thank you for taking the time to do this. Really appreciate you.
Oh, man, I appreciate it too, Ben. Thanks for asking me. And thanks for doing the podcast, man. I love listening to it. It's I've learned a lot from people I didn't even know what their careers were. And it's such a useful tool for all of us. So I appreciate you doing it.
Wow. Thank you. I appreciate that. It's great to hear that. It helps put a little fire under my ass to keep doing it. So thank you.
That's great. Oh, that's awesome.
All right, man. So be in touch, okay?
All right. Hey, thanks, Ben.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Secret Sonics. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. If you've been digging the show, it would be awesome if you could share this episode or your favorite episode with a friend or two, and or leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or your podcatcher of choice. That's it for now. Have a great week. Take care and dig in. See you soon. Bye-bye.